The Guardian. Hello and welcome to Guardian Football Weekly with me, Melissa Rudd, standing in for Max Rushton. The Premier League is back, and so was Jose Mourinho at Stamford Bridge as Chelsea's stoppage time equaliser sparked chaos on the touchline. No dramatic goals at Man City, just beautiful ones as they hit five past Burnley. Important second half ones as Cardiff leapt off the foot of the table to seal their first win. Over in Spain, Real Madrid end their record-breaking goal drought but lose again. Lionel Messi netted a trademark one and assisted another before a fractured arm sport Barcelona. Day, while Cristiano Ronaldo notched up his 400th, but it wasn't enough for Juve. We'll also discuss the Football League, Fitbar Corner, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. We have a panel. Barry Glendenin, you're first.
Hello, welcome to Big Chair. How does it feel?
Feels utterly surreal to be the other side of the glass, but good.
Delight to hear it.
Jonathan Wilson, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Good. And Paul McInnes, how are you?
I'm also grand, thank you.
So just before you get started, because you've spent so much, your Football Weekly involvement has been on the other side of the glass, so I think our listeners need a chance to get to know you.
So right.
We're going to give you a little pop quiz. If producer Sammy could cue the music. Your name?
Melissa Rudd. I was waiting for the beat.
Occupation?
Broadcast journalist.
All right. Melissa Rudd, your specialist subject is the life and times of yourself. You have 1 minute to answer questions, and your time starts now. Stop shaking your head at me. A season ticket holder at Norwich City, at the age of 7, you attended your first match at Carrow Road. Against what team were Norwich playing, and what was the score?
Sheffield United 0-0.
Correct. You attended the University of Lincoln, which was famously disparaged on the popular sitcom The Inbetweeners. Which character is credited with the quote, "Goodbye first-rate education, hello University of Lincoln"?
Oh, the head of sixth form, the head teacher, but I can't remember his name.
I need what's on the card. It was Mr. Gilbert. And which character said, "I've been to Lincoln and it's a shithole"?
I don't know. That's terrible.
It was Will. In October 2016, almost 2 years ago to the day, you queued in the cold for several hours outside a London branch of Waterstones to get a book signed and have your picture taken with which American rock singer?
Bruce Frederick Joseph Springsteen.
Early in your career at the radio station TalkSport, where your duties as assistant producer included handing bits of paper and poorly made, excessively milky mugs of tea to which hugely popular Sunday morning broadcast duo?
Well, the show is called The Warm-Up with Max Rushton, so I'm going with that.
Thank you. And after leaving TalkSport for Sky Sports and subsequently moving to BBC East Anglia, where you now appear in front of camera, occasionally at petting zoos, I've started so I'll finish, or talking about the pedestrianisation of Norwich City Centre, you've finally reached the pinnacle of broadcasting by taking the presenter's chair previously occupied with great distinction by James Richardson and with considerably less distinction by Max Rushton. Now you've got your feet under the studio table. When the time comes, will you give it up willingly?
No, of course not. Not willingly. I'm here to stay for all of two pods.
Thank you for that.
What an introduction.
What's your weird thing with London tap water?
Oh, well, actually, it's tap water anywhere apart from in East Anglia. I can't drink it because the mineral content makes me feel ill. So when I went to Lincoln for 3 years and I lived there because I was at university, I had to buy tap water even to boil pasta, which gets really expensive when you're a skint student.
So there's a particular makeup of the minerals in East Anglia that you have been raised on.
Yeah, you know, Paul, you're from Norwich. You know how hard the water is in East Anglia.
It is very
you?
Hard, isn't yeah. it? That's right.
Does it carry a flick?
But isn't it hard in London as well? But
well, I would just say dirty in London.
That's more like it. You just come to the Big Smoke and you're just all worried about infections.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. So I'm really glad that you brought that up, Jonathan. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
And because you did that, I'm coming to you first.
Okay.
On Chelsea 2, Manchester United 2. Let's talk about the football rather than what went on the touchline first. A deserved point for the hosts or unlucky for Jose Mourinho?
No, I think a draw was probably about right in the end. I think Chelsea were significantly the better side in the first half, and United, as has been their way recently, when they had to chase a game, looked much better. And then the odd thing, and I think the thing that would really worry me if I were a United fan, or a United fan who wants Mourinho to stay at least, is that the thing he's meant to be good at, closing games down, as soon as he tried to do that and brought on Herrera and Pereira, they buckled again. So they've now let in 16 goals this season, which is more than, I think, anybody else in the top half. It's more than Mourinho's Chelsea let in his entire first season in English football. And they've now let in 20 goals from set plays. And even the equaliser, though, it wasn't technically a set play. It was effectively a set play because you got centre-backs going up for the throw-in. And that, I think, is a major concern. Those are basics. And if you think back to last season, Guardiola clearly targeted that at Old Trafford, and City's two goals came from corners. So if even your little tippy-tappy City have scored against you from corners, that's a major issue, and it doesn't seem one he's able to resolve.
Well, they conceded 4 goals in their first 9 games last season. They've conceded 16 in the same number this season. Why is that, Paul?
I suspect there are intricate tactical reasons, and also, as Jonathan suggests, sort of ideas that are around and about with coaches that they think they can exploit, and United still haven't fixed. But I would add to that, there's probably the fact that Mourinho has been trashing his defence for the past 6 months, and they probably don't have the same amount of confidence in their own abilities as they once did.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the goals on Saturday, Pogba just doesn't pick up Rudiger. Really basic stuff, just lets him go. And then even the second goal, okay, the David Luiz header is a really good header. I wouldn't really blame Chris Smalling for not getting up to challenge him. But when the ball comes down, the first two touches, Rudiger gets there, there's a save, and still Barkley's under no pressure to tuck it in. So how in the middle of a six-yard box, when you're defending a lead with 6 minutes in injury time, does this sort of vacuum open up?
The flip side of that, with the sort of the mentality aspect of it, is that when United were off the leash, you know, at 1-0 down in the second half, they played really vibrant football and they looked sharp and incisive and, you know, that sort of stuff that's so frequently missing from their play.
And I think the point that Sarri made, that for that half hour when United were on top, Chelsea were forced to play United's game, they were forced to play a more physical game. So United were able to impose that on them. So if that is their strength, why would you not do that all the time?
Yeah. I was thinking about this on the way in this morning, and I wonder if it's just in that balance there that, you know, Mourinho wants you to play aggressive and assertive and to score goals, but more importantly than that, he doesn't want you to make horrendous mistakes or mistakes that can open you up. And it's about finding that balance where you don't do that so you don't get in trouble, but at the same time you have the confidence to play your game. And I think it's a very tricky balance to find.
But the equalising goal came sort of originally from a long throw, and even that, Nemanja Matic had a chance to clear the ball before it went back into the mixer for the Luiz header, and rather than just put his boot through it, because, you know, it's the final minute of added time, it was a very half-hearted attempt at a clearance, and that allowed, I think it was Azpilicueta, to get the ball back in to tee up Luiz for that towering header. But, I mean, Johnson, do you think, obviously, Jose's main aim is to not concede, and that his team don't seem capable of that. So do you think he should send them out to attack more?
Yeah, and I think...
And do you think he ever will?
Of course he will.
No, I don't think he will now. And I think this is the difference between Mourinho now and the Mourinho of, say, a decade ago. So the thing I was... When I saw the United's selection with Rashford and Martial and Mata playing behind Lukaku, the thing it reminded me of was... Inter went to Stamford Bridge in 2010, maybe 2009. Anyway, that 2009-10 season. And they needed, it must have been the knockout phase, it must have been early 2010. They needed a win, and they attacked. And they had a very attacking lineup. So Pandev must have been in it, and Eto, and Schneider, and Milito. Must have been all four of them. And it was a very, you know, a similarly attacking lineup. And they put pressure on Chelsea by attacking. And Mourinho then was a pragmatist in the true sense, that he did what it took to win the game, which was the counterintuitive thing of attacking. He's now, I think, a pragmatist in the football sense, which is not real pragmatism. It just pragmatism in football just means defensive. And he's become ideologically, dogmatically defensive, when the pragmatic thing to do with this squad, particularly how they, given how they've started the season, would be to be more attacking.
Do you think maybe he does it out of spite? Because
I think
because
absolutely
he's criticised for doing
it. Yeah, and I think he, you know, he's, I think it's just, it begins in 2008 when he doesn't get the Barcelona job. He decides to be the anti-Barcelona, to willfully play ugly football, to willfully play without the ball. You look back at his Porto teams. I mean, they did that at times in Europe because they were, you know, significantly the weaker side. But most league games, they took the game to the opposition, they pressed, they used their lead to press. And, you know, he now seems to, you know, eschew pressing almost altogether. So I think he's taken an ideological stance, which is almost spites himself at times. And I think on.
Yeah. I also just think he won't accept that it can't work.
Well, yeah. He has to prove he was right, yeah.
And interestingly as well, because when they went 2-1 up, he ordered the players back into their shell.
As I said, he brought on Herrera, and Herrera took off Mata and Martial.
Can I just make a little point about Chelsea? I thought it was quite... I wonder what you thought, Jonathan, having only seen the highlights myself, about the Kante situation. Because I noted that, like, you know, he made six tackles and two interceptions in the game, which is kind of like, you know, not what he used to be doing. And I just thought that assist from Rashford for the second goal, that was exactly the sort of place I would have expected Kante to have been in and sort of stopped that from happening.
Yeah, there's a problem there, I think, more generally, that... I mean, you're right. I don't think the position he's in gets the best out of Kante. That he's now sort of a box-to-box player rather than, you know, Jorginho, you know, is a different type of holding player. And so maybe you would want to pair the two and play more of a 4-2-3-1, but Sarri hasn't done that for years. But the problem they've got... I mean, Kante did have one very good shot in the second half that De Gea saved, low to his right. But Kante is not a goal scorer. Kovacic is not a goal scorer. Jorginho is not a goal scorer. There's no goals from that centre midfield. Morata doesn't score goals and Giroud doesn't score goals. So there's no goals at all coming from the centre of the pitch. And there was twice with score at 0-0 when Hazard sort of created opportunities, and the first time he pulled it back to Kante, who was sort of 20 yards out, and he was screaming, you know, crying out for the first time shot. And he tries to play this very strange little stabby give and go in a crowded box. It's never going to work. You know, you just had to hit it first time, but his instinct is not to do that. And then a couple of minutes later, I think it was the move that led to the corner that led to the first goal. Hazard makes this great little run, ball through to him from, I think, Kovacic. And then he squares it, doesn't look, just squares it across the top of 6 yard box. There's nobody there. Well, either Morata's got to be there or a midfielder breaking beyond him. Because where else is the ball going to go? What else is Hazard going to do other than put the ball across the top of 6 yard box? And there's nobody getting onto that. So that's why I think Chelsea, well as they've started the season, I doubt they'll be able to sustain a title chance because I don't think they have the goals from the middle of the pitch. I guess they might cling on and sign somebody in January. I think their one hope of actually winning the league.
Just going back to United, Martial with both goals. No player has scored more since his debut for Man United and that was in September 2015. Has he been underused, do you think, by Mourinho?
Yeah, almost certainly. But he's similar to Rashford's story, isn't it? I mean, he's not the finished product. And so he's going to need to develop in some first team minutes. But again, I've only ever met a Mourinho in a press conference, which is a particular dynamic that doesn't mean you get to know him particularly well. But I do kind of think it's that anti-risk mentality. And so therefore, you know, he can't have players making mistakes, and young players make mistakes, and Martial will have made umpteen mistakes, particularly defensively, but there'll also have been times he won't have optimally used the ball when in possession, and so he's been in and out of the team. Both his finishes were excellent on Saturday.
Well, and the game changed when he and Rashford got further forward in the second half, not just because it was more natural for them, but also there was actually people supporting Lukaku. So Lukaku, who had an anonymous first half, suddenly he's not this isolated figure with 40 yards of space around him. He's somebody who can knock the ball down to people and can interact with them, and that makes him much more effective.
Barry, we have to talk about what happened on the touchline when the equaliser went in. Jose Mourinho reacting. Well, it was bizarre because the camera angle that you saw for the game, you couldn't see. It was Sarri's assistant, wasn't it, Marco Ianni? You couldn't see what he did. You just saw sort of somebody in a grey tracksuit run down the line, look at him, and then something obviously flipped and he reacted. it's all over now. You know, he said that he's apologised, he's accepted it, which is perhaps isn't what you normally get with Mourinho. These things tend to linger on when he has disputes with people. But, I mean, what do you make of that? Was he in the wrong? Was Mourinho in the wrong?
Well, I wouldn't agree that it's all over, because I think the FA are... may have something to say about it when the referee's report comes in.
Yeah, in terms of Mourinho's grudge.
Look, Jose Mourinho has taunted opposition, you know, managers on many, many occasions in the past. There was this famous sort of knee slide at Old Trafford, I think was the first of many. And while he did acknowledge he has form in the field, I can understand why he was upset that one of Sarri's backroom staff taunted him. But I think it's a bit of a storm in a teacup. There were lots of men in high-vis jackets on hand to prevent him from getting to the staff member in question, whose name I've forgotten, Ianni, I think it is.
Marco Ianni.
Marco Ianni, who I don't think any of us... Well, I certainly had never heard of him before the weekend. But yeah, he had to clamber across a couple of seats to go. I did at first think it was a supporter, but these things happen. I don't think it was a very big deal. But by way of precedent, Alan Pardew taunted Arsene Wenger famously once. Wenger reacted, and it was Wenger that got punished. So precedent would suggest Jose could get punished for this. And I'd say if he did, he'll feel very, very hard done by, and would probably be entitled to feel hard done by.
I think he was just milking it for the cameras myself.
Yeah.
Like, I'm passionate. I care. You don't talk to me about that, my team. I'll
defend. Well, and also a diversionary thing of, oh, look, here's another ball in the box we haven't defended properly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, to be fair, Mourinho, I don't think he's ever done anything quite as gratuitous as sort of standing right in front of the opposition manager, sort of pumping his fist in his face. So I think, you know, Yanni was clearly significantly out of order.
There will be those who point out that he once blindsided a Barcelona assistant manager by gouging his eye from behind.
Well, I mean, yeah.
But that's technically not a taunt. That's an assault.
Well, a big week for United, of course. They host Juventus tomorrow night in the Champions League. Cristiano Ronaldo returning to Old Trafford. Let's go on to the next game, though. Man City 5, Burnley 0. Some fantastic goals from City in this game. 5 different goal scorers as well. But as good as the performance was, important to mention, it could have been very different had Vincent Kompany been sent off for his lunge on Aaron Lennon in the very first minute of the game, Jonathan.
Yeah, I think he was looking to get away with that, and probably the fact it was the first minute saved him. But, you know, it was a high challenge, he's out of control. You know, he caught him sort of high up on the thigh. So, yeah, I mean, that could easily have been a red. And I thought Sane could easily have been sent off as well. I mean, Kompany have, what's the word? I have a certain level of sympathy with him in that I don't think he meant to do it. I think he was stretching for a bouncing ball, perhaps didn't see the Burnley player. But yeah, Sane's was, he knew exactly what he was doing, and it was a horrible tackle, and he could have been sent off. And Burnley also obviously felt hard done by with the second goal.
Yeah.
I have to say, I still haven't seen a camera angle that proves conclusively whether that ball went out or didn't. But David Silva was offside anyway, so yeah, shouldn't have stood.
He has a bit of a thing, doesn't he, for rash challenges in the first 10 minutes. I think he got sent off in a Manchester derby once in the first 10, 15 minutes of Kompany. And certainly I watched him at Leicester last season. He should have been sent off in 10 minutes. Maybe he knows that the referee is less likely to... You leave one on early doors and you'll be more than likely to get away
with
it.
His dad's just been elected mayor of a Belgian town, hasn't he?
Well, now
yeah,
he's got...
I saw that, yeah.
That's not relevant to him kicking around in the first minute.
How do we know? It might be. Yeah.
Maybe his dad, the mayor, has influence. Far-reaching.
He didn't get on the score sheet, Kevin De Bruyne, but he did make a return in the 58th minute. Is it scary to imagine just how good they'll be once he's back and fully in form when they've been this good?
Yeah, I mean, they've been really good anyway. You know, they've, I think, a slightly slow start of the season, but the last month or so, they've been excellent. You know, they've dropped 4 points. So, roughly the quarterway point of the season, they'd on course dropped 16 points, which would be 2 worse than last season. But, you know, they still look sensationally good.
Because I don't think Burnley defended particularly badly in that game. And
when people are pinging the ball in the top corner from 25 yards every time.
Well, you don't stop when the whistle doesn't go, though, do you?
Yeah, that was basics, wasn't it? Yeah. That was what you get told.
But just,
I don't want to use the schoolboy cliche, but it is, you know, play to the whistle, and all of them stopped. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, okay, I'll give you that one. But say, for example, the Fernandinho screamer, if you freeze your TV as the ball hits the back of the net, there's a line of five Burnley players between him and the goal. One of the other goals was seven or eight Burnley players in the box, but the precision and speed of City's passing, there's just very little they could do about it. And I'm inclined to think that even if Kompany had walked, they would still have won the game comfortably.
I mean, there's that thing that about Sean Dyche's Burnley and how, you know, much possession or much of the pitch they're willing to concede, and they'll come right into the box and around the 6 yard because they, you know, that's where you put your bodies on the line and you make those blocks, but not when people are pinging the shots top corner over your head. And that's what City can do, a lot of other teams can't.
That's the 10th time Guardiola's won a City game by a 5-goal margin, which is a pretty incredible stat in itself. But, I mean, their goal difference is now plus 23, 10 better than any other team.
No other team's scored more than 20 goals.
Exactly. It's just, you do wonder how any other team is going to get close to Vinny.
Well, the only hope of a proper title race is that Liverpool are level with them, and I think there's a lot more to come from Liverpool. I don't think Liverpool are anywhere near playing to potential yet. So that's the one hope for time. Yeah, I think City will win it by 10 points.
I see quite a lot of Spurs, and Spurs are doing something similar to the Liverpool. You know, it's both the rivals are having to do quite restrained, defensive-oriented approaches to make sure you get over the line and get the 3 points. City don't even have to do that.
I don't think there will be any sort of title race, but again, I would say that game against Huddersfield at Liverpool 1-0, won 1-0. That's the kind of game they'd have drawn or lost last season. They dropped a lot of points to teams who got relegated.
Yeah, I mean, I think they got a bit lucky in that game, didn't they? They were, yeah, Huddersfield hit the post. It was a very tight offside call. Possibly should have had a penalty. Yeah, Liverpool were nowhere near their best, but they win it with a team with a, you know, significant number of changes to it, and they, you know, they get the 3 points and move on. So
they were also about three bad passes away from three good counter-attacking.
Sure, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Interesting what Jurgen Klopp said after that game, though. He said he's winning average games for the first time in his career, which I think we can decipher as meaning perhaps his team aren't playing well and they're still winning games. You know, and you look at, again, we talked about Man United's defensive record, but Liverpool have conceded 16 in their first nine games last season. They've conceded 3 goals in the first nine games of this season. That's huge, isn't it? That's, you know, that's where a 1-0 victory away from home, as you say, wouldn't have come last season.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a different mentality. You know, there is the risk that, as with lots of teams, even down the bottom, you know, Fulham are going to have to do the same thing and sort of entertain less, defend better. But you might lose some of that thrilling attacking football, and you might lose a lot of the goals, and things might be tight. But you've got to have that option to be able to consistently aggregate points over the course of a 38-game season.
It was Mo Salah's first away goal this season as well. His 50th in English football. Has some of the criticism that's come his way this season been a little bit harsh, do you think?
No. No, I mean, I think people have been pretty realistic that he's not playing particularly badly, he's just not scoring goals. He had a similar start to last season. I think he's had quite a few issues with the Egyptian FA and various things back in Egypt over the last couple of months. I don't think anybody's been saying that kind of he's suddenly a hopeless player. They're just pointing out that he's not as effective in front of goal as he was in that sort of golden period in January, February last season.
Yeah, and it was after the second international break that he sort of lit the touch paper last season.
It was after he got that penalty which got Egypt to the World Cup, wasn't it? That sort of seemed to be the ignition for him. Whether his goal against Eswatini has the same impact, the same resonance, I don't know. But
well, it clearly has already.
And it was a lovely finish, one against Huddersfield. Really nice finish.
Huddersfield, they played well, but they've not scored at home now since April. Jonathan Hogg did hit the post, but, you know, that's the closest they came. They're second from bottom, 3 points. How do you see them staying up when they can't score goals?
I don't see them staying up. I mean, they They got away with it to an extent last season, but with that squad, with the level of investment they've had, they're always going to find it difficult. I think they've done incredibly well to get to even to this position. I mean, that sounds slightly patronising. Maybe it is, but it was always going to be a struggle. And Newcastle are doing their best to be worse on them, but other sides aren't.
I think last season, I agree totally with Jonathan, but last season he got away with quite a defensive approach a lot of the time. They would play slow football, and I only saw the second half on Saturday, but it was pretty plodding, you know, when they were 1-0 down and Liverpool didn't seem to be willing to come onto them. They might just have to, the only option they might have is just to try and play more quickly, to take more risks. They do have a problem in that their strikers, their big lads that actually weighed in with a fair amount of goals, you know, don't look on it at the minute, because then you've got that option of just trying to play up to them. But yeah, I think they're going to have to take more risks. Sure.
I don't think they're that far away and might be lucky enough to have three teams worse than them. There's just a bit of finesse missing there, and someone mentioned, you know, passes going astray, and they had five chances to score, you know, reasonable to very good chances to score, hitting the post, that very tight offside, which was offside and incorrectly disallowed. Mounier should have scored towards the end and shanked a ball, which admittedly was spinning and hard to control, over the bar when he should have buried it, I thought. But I would give them hope, but not a huge amount.
Well, one team who did score goals this Saturday at least was Cardiff. They doubled their goal tally for the entire season against Fulham. They beat them 4-2. Fantastic result for them. They're off the foot of the table. How much of it was Cardiff playing very well, and how much of it was Fulham being pretty hopeless at the back?
I think a lot of it was Fulham being pretty hopeless at the back. I mean, the second and fourth goals that Cardiff scored, I mean, both of them, Fulham had three or four chances to clear it and didn't. So it was, yeah, that's not a... You can say the first goal was a structural issue that Murphy got into space behind Callum Chambers. But the second and fourth goals, that's not structural. It's just people not kicking the ball out. It's, you know, not being decisive, not being confident enough, or not having the clarity of perception to just, you know, to clear the ball when the opportunity's there to clear it.
Yeah. Chambers had a torrid time, didn't he? Murphy really had the better of him. He was hauled off at half time. Could have been sent off as well. He was quite lucky not to have been.
Yeah, he should have been sent off, that's true, yeah.
Do you rate Josh Murphy? Is he a decent player?
Melissa will have more insight than me, but for me, he doesn't have... what he lacked for us was consistency.
Absolutely, yep.
And the one thing you thought, if he goes and plays with Neil Warnock, he'll have his game stripped right back to the basics, but he'll be expected to do it consistently.
Yeah.
So it might be good for him, I think.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I think his strengths were always hugging the touchline, running, because he has got pace, running at players. He didn't do that enough at Norwich. I think he would often get the ball cut back. He wouldn't run at players. It'd be so frustrating. When he did, his sort of end product lacked a bit as well. When we got offered $10 million for him, I did think it was good business. But as you say, maybe with Warnock, if he is just told to do that, like he did on Saturday, and he can produce an end product, then maybe there is a good Premier League player in him.
I think he's got the ability to do that. Technically, I think he's good enough.
A moment of history as well in this game. Ryan Sessegnon, the first player born after 2000 to score a Premier League goal. Which is, that makes me
feel old.
And I'm significantly younger than Barry Glendening, so it must make you feel really old.
Are you old? You're older than me, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And wiser.
And more respected, of course. Let's
and let us never forget that.
we talked about how poor Fulham were at the back. Only Southampton in 2012-13 have conceded more than Fulham at this stage, 26 goals. They did stay up, though. But as Louis says, who tweeted in, at their current rate, Fulham will concede 106 goals this season. How does Jurkanovic fix this?
Hang on, 106 or 116?
106. If you do, I did check the maths.
Okay. I saw somebody say they were on course to concede 17 more than the record, but Swindon let in over 100, I think. So, anyway.
I think he has to... One of the things is he hasn't had a settle back four. He went back to the Championship centre-halves of Odoi and Ream, who particularly had a shocker on Saturday.
Is there player of the season.
Exactly, and he fell over. He had a Steven Gerrard for pretty much every one of their goals. And then I think I think the thing is in midfield. They spent 50 million plus on two players, Seri being one, and this Anguissa guy who hasn't really featured as of yet. Both defensive midfielders or players who can do that job, and he's still playing with McDonald and Johansson. And well, on Saturday he did anyway. And that might be because of the opposition, but I think there's problems in that midfield. They don't have the right combinations, particularly not at this level. And he's going to have to work that out, because they have to provide. He has to work out who's playing in his back four as well, but they need more protection from the midfield.
I mean, it's just an obvious thing, but if you're letting in three goals every game, which on average they are, I mean, you've got to score four to win the game. That's really hard. So they've got to let in less than three. That'll be my advice.
West Ham 0, Spurs 1. Spurs continue their best ever Premier League start with an important win. Eric Lamela got the goal just before half-time. Spurs, though, do have Hugo Lloris to thank for protecting the points. A great save from Arnautovic. What did you make of this one, Jonathan?
Yeah, and it's good to see Lloris back in form. I think he's a bit of a shaky start of the season. Plus, he had the drink drive thing. So you wonder if there is something going on in the background. But yeah, the save from Arnautovic was an excellent save. And I think Lloris is important to them because he is so quick off his line. I don't think he's necessarily the best passer of the ball, but he's very quick at leaving his box, which allows him to play the higher line. And I think when Vaughan plays, they struggle a little bit with that. So I think his style of goalkeeper is essential to them, and that makes him sort of doubly important.
It was a really bad game. I was there, and it was really, 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 really boring. It was like difficult to focus your eyes on it because it was just like...
It's a long way away as well, to be fair.
Well, that's true. And particularly when you're looking through binoculars, it's kind of, hard. But I thought both teams sort of impressed with their determination in the game. And you know, this has been a consistent strain for Spurs this season, that they're sort of winning despite all the grey clouds around them. And they did that again. Lamela had a great game, and Sissoko, stepped up too. It was lots of, not a great game, but lots of positives to take from it. And I think West Ham will probably look at that in the same way. There was bad news for them in Yarmolenko. It looks like he might be out for 6 months.
Yeah.
But they're not short on wide attacking forwards. They bought on two, Antonio and this Guangana, I'm not even going to get the name right, but anyway, they brought on two wide forwards. They've got options there, I think they dug in. They were organised, and I think that's, they're a long way from where they were this time last year.
Yeah, reports today said Yarmolenko might have ruptured his Achilles. West Ham yet to confirm that, but as you say, could be out for 6 months.
Well, I think he is a big loss for them. I mean, even though they have other players playing that position, just because of his physical heft, I sort of hadn't quite appreciated how strong he is. I was at the game when they won at Everton, when he scored twice, but he was really impressive generally. Just he wins the ball, he holds it up in a way that, say, Felipe Anderson just doesn't.
No, that's right. I mean, he struggled. He had a difficult game. They're going to need him to step up.
He was at fault for the goal, wasn't he, Felipe Anderson?
Yeah, I mean, he got done by Sissoko, basically. But Sissoko, you ask about what he's doing back in that role. Well, he was obviously trying to help, but I don't think that's his forte. But offensively, he didn't offer anything. He never beat his man outright.
Are you surprised, Jonathan, by what passes for the resurgence of Sissoko?
What do you mean?
Well, I think a lot of Spurs fans were very down on him, and he seems to have played his way back into their good books.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a slightly odd player. I remember, I think the last time I was on, I was talking about Ross Barkley as somebody who I completely accepted he was a good player because everybody told me he was a good player, but I never actually saw him play well. And Sissoko is the opposite. Every time I see Sissoko live, he plays brilliantly. And I never quite understand why there's such criticism of him. But I mean, it's obviously, there's so many people who say it and people who know what they're talking about that there obviously is something there. But, I think his ability to turn Holden players off, I think his physical capacity and allied to his passing ability makes him, when he's playing well, makes him ideal for that role, sort of just in front of Eric Dier. But I mean, he's also surprisingly old, isn't he? He's 31, I think.
I couldn't tell you.
So he's a player who sort of In my head, he's slightly younger than he is in real life.
On to Newcastle. They lost 1-0 at home to Brighton. Berhem Kayal's strike means they are only the third side in Premier League history to lose their first five home games. Rafa Benitez's side also now have a worse start than they did under Steve McLaren. Boos at full-time as well. The pressure's on him big time, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but in a slightly strange way in that he's still, although he's now beginning to draw a bit of criticism, he's still clearly not the focus of it at Newcastle. That Mike Ashley is still, going to take the brunt of the blame.
It's a nice big human shield to have in front.
Well, especially now he's started turning up again. I mean, I don't know what that actually means, but it feels like it means something that he's been, I think, to the last three games. I think he went to the Palace game, and then whoever they played last time out, and then Saturday. They looked slightly unlucky, I think. I mean, only seeing the highlights, but. You know, the fact that the goal is a massive deflection, and it came following a corner that clearly wasn't a corner.
Yeah, it should have been a goal kick.
Newcastle had a couple of chances, but yeah, it's clearly not bad luck at the bottom of the table. There's a lot wrong with that squad and that side.
Chris Hughton will have enjoyed that win, of course, against his former side. Brighton hadn't won away in 17 away league games either, so it was a big win. Should also mention Glenn Murray stretchered off after that awful clash of heads. He's out of hospital now though, which is good news, recovering from concussion. Well, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll cover the rest of the Premier League, chat to Sid in Spain after another miserable weekend for Real Madrid, and talk Thierry Henry's managerial debut. Welcome back to part two. Let's wrap up the rest of the Premier League first. Wolves 0, Watford 2. Two goals in 58 seconds gave Watford a brilliant win over Wolves. They lost at home for the first time this season. In fact, the first time since January. Barry, you saw this one?
Yeah, I don't think anyone was expecting this. I thought Watford had done their sort of Downing Tools Act already this season, having got off to such a good start. But blip well and truly over. Etienne Capoue opened the scoring with, a great shot, slightly fortuitous insofar as Conaconi had his legs akimbo and allowed the ball safe passage through. Pereira didn't even move for it. He was sort of at the wrong side of his goal. And then I think 58 seconds later, Pereira scored with a wonderful flick with the outside of his left foot, which I think is a particularly nice way to score a goal. I say that as a lefty, and a lefty who scored very few of them. But and a particularly impressive performance by Watford because they were missing several key players. Deeney, Gray, Holabas and Calabasela were all out. So, yeah, it was a surprise win for them and a bit of a wake-up call for Wolves, I suppose, after a very good start to the season.
Well, Bournemouth 0, Southampton 0. The first note I've got under this game is Mark Hughes believed a point at the Vitality Statement was a statement following their defeat to Chelsea, which says it all about this game, really. It did end a streak of three defeats, but Southampton have now gone four games without scoring. The last time they did that was 2004-05 when they were relegated. So worrying for their fans.
Yeah, I still don't see it with Saints. I mean, I've watched them a couple of times in the flesh this season, and they just don't have the right players in the right spots to do damage in this division, I don't think.
Just one game yesterday, Everton beat Crystal Palace 2-0. Palace did miss a penalty as well at 0-0. Wilfred Zaha won a penalty when he was brought down by Seamus Coleman. Milivojevic's effort, though, straight down the middle and saved by Jordan Pickford. Really, a lot of this game could have been summed up in the last 20 minutes, couldn't it? Not a lot happened before.
Yeah, I only saw the first 70, unfortunately. I had to go and do an interview, so I saw the penalty save, and that was about it. And I did see it on Match of the Day too, where Jordan Pickford just wasn't playing ball with Mark Chapman at all. Mark Chapman was trying to get him to talk about how goalkeepers prepare for penalties, and Pickford was sort of, I didn't do my research for this one. I might have forgotten my research. Did you look at the bench? No, I just looked at his run-up. But yeah, it was, once he'd gone the wrong way, he did very well to get a strong foot on it. And then the substitutions clearly made a big difference for him.
Yeah, good. And Calvert-Lewin's continuing his development, isn't he? I mean, you know, it might not be too long till he's in this England senior squad as well.
Lovely cross as well from Luckman. I mean, you know, it would have been easy for him to try and do too much on that, but just sort of, you know, created enough space across and sort of stabbed it in.
Luckman, Calvert-Lewin and Tosin, who scored the second goal, all brought on as subs by Marco Silva. And as you were saying, about Calvert-Lewin, Paul, no player has scored more goals for Everton since the start of last season than Calvert-Lewin. That was his 12th, so he is doing really well. Palace maybe a bit unlucky. If they'd have put the penalty away, it could have been very different. Their next four games, though: Arsenal at home, Chelsea away, Spurs at home, Man United away.
Yeah, and they don't have a centre forward at the minute because Benteke's not there. I mean, Zaha, yeah, does a job, but
Conor Wickham made his triumphant return to first team action yesterday.
Oh, come on, Barry. We both know what happens if you hang your Premier League survival hopes on Conor Wickham.
He almost single-handedly kept Sunderland up.
Yeah,
one
and
season.
To be fair, he'd left by the time we did go down. So.
He's kind of streaky scoring so far. If he can get one, he'll get three or four and go on a run.
Yeah, how often did that happen for Sunderland? I think it was once.
I think it happened at least three times. But anyway, he's better than nothing. I like Conor Wickham, but yeah, I appreciate he's not one to pin your hopes on. But he is better than nothing, and it's good to see him back after such a long time out. Yeah. Conor Wickham actually. A friend of mine's a taxi driver and brought Conor Wickham and his girlfriend to the hospital the day they were having their first child, and Conor Wickham gave him a £20 tip. My mate asked him for a selfie, and I said, you didn't seriously ask a man whose wife was in the throes of labour to stop for a selfie? And he went, no, she wasn't in labour. You know, they had an appointment. So, Good on Conor Wickham. He's generous.
Well, the Monday night football tonight is Arsenal against Leicester. Arsenal can leapfrog Spurs into fourth with a win over Claude Puel's side and make it 10 in a row in all competitions with a win. Let's get to Spain now, though. Sid Lowe is on the line. Hello, Sid.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you.
Good, good. Sid, as we speak, Julen Lopetegui is still in charge of Real Madrid. Might not be, though, for much longer after they lost again at the weekend.
Yeah, and in a way, it's not just the weekend's defeat. It's this run of games. They haven't won now in five. They've lost four of those. They've lost three games in a row. But I think it's even deeper than that. It's a lack of trust in him. And one of the things that always undermines managers at Real Madrid is it's not just that there is a lack of trust, but that lack of trust is shared. And of course, that deepens the kind of divide. And managers are always aware that the club is losing faith in them for a number of reasons. In this particular case, Lopetegui's position is a curious one because, in a way, the two key factors that led to him becoming Real Madrid manager at the time at which he did become Real Madrid manager in the summer, of course, when he was 2 days away from taking Spain to the World Cup, the two fundamental factors there were the lack of alternatives and the lack of time. And it's precisely the lack of alternatives and the lack of time that means he's still in the job now. Real Madrid haven't had the opportunity to get replacement in. They haven't been able to find people to take over from him or even indeed find the moment to do it. I think there might be a certain sense of regret from the Real Madrid board now that perhaps they didn't act earlier, because of course we've just come off the back of an international break, and when in theory you do have the time, although you still can't necessarily get your candidates in. It's a couple of weeks since they first spoke to the people around Antonio Conte, for example, and now they're in a position where they've got a Champions League game tomorrow, they've got the Clásico at the weekend, and there's another weird element of this, which is that Clásicos always feel like moments that define seasons and also define managers. And to give you a really good example, Rafa Benitez was beaten 4-0 in the Clásico by Barcelona, 4 years ago. And that was the end of Rafa Benitez. It was over. And yet he actually stayed in it. This was in October. He stayed in the job until January. So the question mark now is when Madrid find the moment to do this. And there is a risk with this weekend's Clásico. And I know this sounds stupid, but bear with me on it. The risk is that Real Madrid win it. And they're stuck with Lopetegui. So they're now in this kind of position where they think, well, what do we do now? Because the bottom line is they've decided he's not the right manager. They just now need to find the moment in which to do this.
Sid, Paul McInnes here. I'm just wondering, is it possible that the circumstances of Lopetegui leaving Spain have in some way impacted upon his ability to make a success of the job at Real Madrid?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes. I think it's perfectly possible, and I think it's the case, and I think it's the case for a number of reasons. That the thing is, I don't think it's a direct causal relationship, if you see what I mean. But I think that the circumstances, you know, as I was saying before, the circumstances in part are the speed with which it happened, the sense that put extra pressure upon him, and you know, we said at the time, and we talked about this endlessly at the time when he was sacked from Spain, we were saying, well, yeah, in 6 months' time when Real Madrid sack him, he'll be thinking, what the bloody hell was the point of all of that? You know, I gave up so much for so little. And of course, at Real Madrid, the sack is always an option. I mean, that's the thing. The sack is the ultimate conclusion of any time at Real Madrid, except Zidane. Zidane's the only coach in the entire time since Florentino Perez has been present who's chosen exactly when to go and exactly how to go. And now, obviously, the sack was going to come to Lopetegui at some stage. The fact that he got the job was partly because that following Zidane, a whole load of other managers said no. They didn't want to be the person put in this impossible position. He took it on. That, I think, wasn't necessarily problematic because, you know, someone had to do the job at some stage. And when they played brilliantly against Roma and they scored four at Girona, we started to think, well, you know, we can see things here. But he also walked into an environment which Cristiano Ronaldo had gone, in which when Zidane left, he'd essentially said very carefully and very politely, but he essentially said, you know, things need to change here. And some of those other things haven't changed. So I think it's partly a product of that, but not in the sense that necessarily leaving Spain did this. But that was part of a cocktail of circumstance and that have created the conditions that meant that this was always quite likely.
Sid, is he a bit of a laughing stock in Spain, and will he struggle to find work after this?
I wouldn't go so far as to say he's a laughing stock. I think everybody recognises that mistakes have been made. I think that the interpretation of what happened in the summer of the Spanish national team depends very much on your position, as is so often the case in Spain. You know, the interpretation of things is always done through the prism of trenches dug, depending on which side you're on, which tends to be divided by Madrid and Barcelona rather than necessarily by the national team. I think there is a sense that you know, he's a manager who might have done something really good at the World Cup, but was A, the victim of his own desire to get the Madrid job, B, the victim of Real Madrid's refusal to wait, C, the victim of the Federation's decision to take a stand on this, which may or may not have been necessary. He was never seen as blameless, but I don't think he was seen as entirely to blame for what happened this summer. I think the results that Madrid are going through now, again, most people would look at these and say, well, there's a whole series of factors. It's not just him. So I think he will struggle for some jobs after this. He certainly will struggle for jobs at the level that he's been at. Obviously, Spain and Real Madrid are the two biggest jobs in the country, with the Barcelona one. He's never going to get that. But I don't think people are laughing at him, no.
Sid, Barcelona back up to the top of the league. They beat informed Sevilla quite convincing as well, 4-2 at the Nou Camp.
Well, I was going to say they played very well. They played very well for the 15 minutes that Leo Messi was on the pitch, already 2-0 up. He's broken his arm, and so there's a real sense that while this was an important performance for a Barcelona team that hadn't won in four games, while they hadn't entirely convinced, while this was first against second going into the weekend's matches, and, you know, we were starting to ask ourselves whether Sevilla were a genuine candidate, this was a big victory for Barcelona in terms of not just the fact that they got the 3 points, but the conviction with which they did it. But to come at the cost of Messi, I think really does hit them hard. And it hits them hard in what's a really bad time to lose him. So obviously they reckon it'll be about 3 weeks that he's out. Although everybody now, I must admit, myself included, sort of thinking, oh, it's only an arm. What do you need an arm for? You don't need an arm to play football. But you know, it's reckoned to be about 3 weeks that he'll be out. And it's 3 weeks in which they play Inter Milan twice, to very much define their future in the Champions League, in which they play Real Madrid with the opportunity to leave them perhaps 7 points behind. And, you know, it isn't an exaggeration to say that Barcelona are really not that good without Leo Messi for the most part. And, you know, his influence on them, not just in terms of the goals he scores and the assists, but in the entire way they play, is gigantic. And being in the Camp Nou on Saturday night, the sense when he went down, and he was down for a long time and took a long time to make the change, it was about 9 or 10 minutes. And then it was almost as if the next 20 minutes of the game was like, well, yeah, but what does that matter? You know, everyone wants to know what's wrong with Messi, whether this is a break or not, whether this is something that keeps him out of the Clásico and so on. So while the win was a big one, I think the cost for them is huge.
And elsewhere, Atletico got an away draw at Villarreal. So all round, Messi's injury aside, it was almost a perfect weekend for Barca, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it fell into place really nicely for them. And if you look at the league table at the moment, the league table is quite bizarre. You've got the two teams from Barcelona, first and second in the league. Espanyol being in second place is extraordinary. Alaves, a third at the moment, via the Leith, are in a European place. Real Madrid are not even in the European place. There's only, I think it's 6 points between first and tenth. I think there's only 2 points between the top six. It's been a really bizarre season so far, obviously partly defined by the fact that Madrid and Barcelona have dropped a lot of points. But I think all the way through the league, those of us who want to look at it from an optimistic point of view rather than a pessimistic one, and obviously time will tell whether that's the right way of looking at it, there's a real sense that this year's a bit different and it's a bit more exciting. Now, look, the likelihood is that Barcelona and maybe Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid, depending on how quickly they sort out some of their problems, will accelerate away from the rest. But for the time being, at least, 9 weeks into the season, it's quite a lot of fun.
Sid, great to talk to you this morning.
Pleasure.
See you later. Bye.
Cheerio.
On to France now. Paul McInnes, are you willing to share what you shared in our pre-record WhatsApp group about this league, or
break
or not?
The confidential Chatham House rules of our WhatsApp group?
Well, absolutely. The WhatsApp group stays in the WhatsApp group, I would say.
Well, I just know. Basically, what happened was I've got a really busy week on, and I just got up and I was like getting into sort of get my Premier League stuff prepped for this pod, and then I saw that 2/3 of it was going to be about European leagues, and I was like, oh bloody hell, I know nothing. So I texted on the WhatsApp group that I thought France was a Mickey Mouse competition and we shouldn't do anything about it. And having watched the goalkeeping error that caused Monaco to lose in Thierry Henry's first game in charge, I stick by that opinion.
It was pretty terrible, wasn't it, Barry? You didn't see the highlights, even though I sent them to you. Helpful.
For the benefit of the listening audience, I shook my head as Melissa prepared to address that question to me.
Well, you must have seen them.
Yeah, I saw it. It was a bit of a curious moment. The guy, it was a long-range effort, and the keeper went up to Sai, I think his name is, put his arms up to claim it, but a weak wrist, and it deflected off and into the side of the net. You know, 2-1 defeat away at Strasbourg. It's probably not a massive scandal, but what is quite shocking is Monaco are second from bottom. So you look at them and you think, oh, they've sold all the crown jewels and that's why they're suffering, but they've still got Jovetic and Falcao up front. They signed Chadli in the summer after an excellent World Cup. You know, going forward, that's a European standard side. So there's problems.
Jimmy Tielemans, Kamil Glick.
Yeah, and Tielemans scored the late penalty. You look at the defence and it's like, yeah, maybe some of these are the players who are still part of that old Jardim side who haven't been able to leave the club and maybe they're not as happy as they once were. I don't know. He says shooting at the moon for some possible explanation.
Well, that's it for part two. In part three, we'll do Fitbar Corner. Hopefully, Barry, you've done research on that as you don't seem to have done for much else. The Football League and get a roundup from Bundesliga and Serie A as well. Welcome back to part three. We'll start in Scotland. Fitbar Corner, Barry Glendenning.
Under strict instructions to rattle through part three, so I'll keep it short. The game of the weekend was undeniably Celtic v Hibs. Celtic won 4-2. And it was a humdinger which only people who were in Celtic Park Stadium got to see. There's a bit of contention that it wasn't on TV because there's some weird rule about only so many games per venue are allowed to be shown each season, so this one didn't end up being broadcast. That honour went to Hamilton and Rangers on Sunday afternoon. Rangers beat Hamilton 4-1, so, and Hearts with a 2-1 victory over Aberdeen. The Hearts juggernaut hurtles on. They're still 3 points clear at the top of the table, ahead of Celtic, who are level on points with Kilmarnock, 19 each. Livingston behind them, and then Rangers back in fifth with 17 points, 5 points off the pace. They play, I think, Spartak Moscow in the Europa League on Thursday, and they've just sacked their manager. I think that's the second team in Rangers have faced in Europe who've sacked their manager just before the encounter, so there's some sort of weird hoodoo going on there. But Melissa, you also drew my attention to Aberdeen have been doing these retro programs this season. They played St Mirren earlier this month and recreated a classic match day program which was voted for by the fans as their favourite program from the same fixture in 1986. And the programme in question featured a young girl, Jenny Duncan, and her little brother, Michael, on the street outside Pataudry. She's leaning against a wall and the shoulder of her dress is snagged on a nail. And her brother, Michael, is wearing a red tracksuit hand-me-down from his sister with the name of the late Neil Cooper on the back. And for the game, 32 years later, the cover was recreated using Dolly's two children, Lily and Ollie. And in it, Ollie wears a Graham Shinney tracksuit top to keep up to date. But yeah, it's just a nice touch and a heartwarming story from a league where not all stories are always heartwarming.
To the Championship now, where it was a heartwarming first game for Dean Smith in charge of Aston Villa. They beat Swansea 1-0 in front of a capacity crowd at Villa Park. Tammy Abraham with the goal. Middlesbrough atop after a 2-1 win at Sheffield Wednesday on Friday night, and Derby beat in-form Sheffield United 2-1 at Pride Park. West Brom also lost Josh Windass's strike enough to give Wigan victory at the DW Stadium. Leeds were beaten at Blackburn in the early kickoff on Saturday. That's just two wins in their last eight now, their fourth. I feel like we should mention Leeds because so much was said about them.
I wrote a column about them and basically they turned rubbish the moment I did it. I think I personally jinxed them.
They looked fantastic at Carrow Road. They beat Norwich 3-0 and you did think, wow, this is they could really do something special. And I know they've had injuries, they have suffered a lot, but what's happened to them?
Well, Jonathan will know better about the weaknesses of or the flaws in the sort of Bielsa plan. But I think, you know, they set about steamrolling teams and then I think they've just caught people unawares and now people are starting to adjust and sort of dig in against them. I just wanted to say one quick thing about the Championship, because there was a graph that showed amount of passes, amount of possession and successful completed passes. And there's this cluster in the top right-hand corner, which is like nine teams, Derby, Norwich, West Brom, everybody in there. They're all tightly packed. It's really as if everybody's sort of similarly dominating these games. And then right down in the bottom corner, Middlesbrough, like who are top of the table. They're just doing something completely different from all the other successful teams in the division and they're top.
Thomas Frank's first game in charge of Brentford ended in a 1-0 defeat as Bristol City scored a late winner. Norwich move into the playoff places after coming from behind to win 2-1 at Nottingham Forest. They've broken their unbeaten home record now. And I will touch on it. Because I'm an Norwich fan. Great win, Paul, wasn't it?
Absolutely fantastic. There's a little clip, 5 seconds, the chance that ends up with Enonel Hernandez hitting the post from 20 yards.
Fluid football.
Totally fluid football. And at the heart of it, Todd Cantwell, 20, from Dereham. Not many pro footballers from Dereham.
No, if any.
What's Dereham?
Exactly.
Dereham is a small market town. Is it a market town? Yeah. About 15 miles outside of Norwich, which has basically got a Tesco's in and not much else. And,
yeah.
So it's a Tesco's?
Well.
No, it's a small market town.
Yeah.
Is it? If you go out of cities, you'll notice them.
Well, I recently had a reason to go to Kenley, which I thought would be quite a large town in South London. Well, it's Kent, really. And it was most perturbed to discover that that too is basically a pub and a Tesco.
There are two nightclubs though in Dereham. There used to be anyway, which is quite strange for a little market town. Anyway, Ipswich rock bottom after a 2-0 home defeat.
What were they called?
By QPR. I don't know. I was too drunk to realise the name when I went in them. It is big enough for two high schools, Dereham, so, you know, it's not that small.
It's getting bigger by the second. It's gone from a Tesco's to a Tesco's, two nightclubs and two schools.
It hopes to join the EU in 2022.
In League One, Portsmouth are now 6 points clear at the top after they beat Joe Barton's Fleetwood 1-0. In second place, Peterborough lost 1-0 at home to Accrington. Sunderland beat Shrewsbury 2-0 to stay third.
Have a game in hand as well. Let's not forget that.
Thanks for that, Jonathan.
It's a pleasure.
Incredible scenes at Doncaster against Gillingham. The game ended 3-3. Doncaster had 32 shots. Gillingham had 3 shots.
It's football.
Quite a stat. And in League Two, Cambridge United got a 1-1 draw at table-topping Lincoln City. They must have known Max wouldn't be on the pod today. There was a controversial red card as well for Imps midfielder Ellis Chapman after 21 minutes in that game with a score already at 1-1. So I feel that's quite important to mention. Lincoln's still top of the league. The second place, Exeter, couldn't take advantage as they drew 0-0 with Carlisle. And MK Dons move into the automatic promotion places after a 1-0 win at home to Northampton. Well, let's go to Italy now and Paolo Bandini with his roundup.
Some people had begun to doubt whether it was going to happen all season, but finally it did. That's right, guys. For the first time, Krzysztof Piątek has failed to score a goal for Genoa. Oh, wait, you wanted to hear about Juventus dropping points, didn't you? Well, funnily enough, that happened in the same game. Despite not getting a goal from Piątek, Genoa were able to come back from a goal down to earn a draw in Turin. Daniel Besser getting the goal instead. How much do we read into this? Probably not all that much. Even the best teams don't actually go through entire seasons winning every match. Juventus were resting several players with an eye on the midweek trip to Manchester United, and they could still have been out of sight with better finishing the first half when Cristiano Ronaldo scored and also hit the woodwork. It wasn't the first time this season they've been caught napping at the back, though, and Leonardo Bonucci has been at fault on 5 of the 6 goals they've conceded in Serie A this season, so perhaps something there for United to target. The bigger game this weekend, though, was the Milan derby, won 1-0 by Inter with an injury-time goal from Mauro Icardi. This was Inter's 7th consecutive win across all competitions and also the 7th goal they've scored in that run within the final quarter hour of a game. There was a downside here too, though, as they lost Raja Nainggolan to injury. He will miss their Champions League visit to Barcelona, and both Ivan Perisic and Marcelo Brozovic are looking doubtful after they picked up more minor knocks as well.
Thanks, Paolo. Inter Milan, of course, going to Barcelona in the Champions League on Wednesday. Let's catch up with Germany now and Archie Rintott.
Kebab shop calling in Cologne after another eventful weekend in the Bundesliga. Have to start with Bayern Munich and not what they did on the pitch either. On Friday, President Uli Hoeneß, Chairman Karl-Heinz Rummenigge and Sporting Director Hasan Salihamidžić assembled for an extraordinary press conference to just call out the press, really. Karl-Heinz Rummenigge dramatically quoted the first article of the German Constitution about human dignity being sacrosanct before he and Bayern very much lost their dignity. They called out journalists, some individually, for being disrespectful, shameless, outrageous, which was all a bit rich. The highlight coming when Uli Hoeneß laid into Juan Bernat, a player who left Bayern for PSG this summer, for nearly costing Bayern the Champions League against Sevilla last season, with some harsher language chucked in there too. The overall reaction from the German press was along the lines of, "Are you having a laugh?" And what effect did it have then on the team in Wolfsburg this weekend? I went along and saw them end their 4-game winless run with a 3-1 victory. Robert Lewandowski ending his scoreless patch too, scoring twice. By no means a performance which said, wow, Bayern are back. Arjen Robben was even sent off in the second half too. But Bayern move up from 6th to 4th this weekend, still some 4 points behind league leaders Borussia Dortmund. They hammered Stuttgart 4-0 away from home. Jadon Sancho at it again, started for the second Bundesliga game running, opened the scoring, albeit deflected in. Pick of the goals, though, coming from the division's top scorer, Paco Alcácer, who managed to lob Ron Robert Seeler inside the Stuttgart box for their 3rd. 7 goals for the season now for him. And Dortmund's closest challengers are Gladbach on 17 points. They thumped Mainz 4-0 on Sunday evening with an unlikely hat-trick from winger Jonas Hofmann. Also on 17 points are Werder Bremen after they won 2-0 away at Schalke. Last year's runners-up, who slipped to their 6th defeat of the season, Maximilian Eggestein, a 21-year-old talent worth watching, scoring both. And another young talent on target with a brace this weekend was Arsenal loanee Reece Nelson. Made a great start to life at Hoffenheim this season. Turned the game around for them away at Nuremberg. 2 very tidy finishes indeed. Up to 4 goals for the season. Have to finish with the performance of the weekend, which came on Friday night. Luka Jovic is the name to remember. 20-year-old Serbian striker scored 5 for Eintracht Frankfurt in a 7-1 win over Fortuna Dusseldorf. Only the second player to score 5 after Robert Lewandowski, of course, in the last 25 years in the Bundesliga.
Thanks, Archie. Well, 5 goals in one game. Jonathan Wilson, you love a stat.
Well, we just passed the Friday was the 50th anniversary of the only time anybody's ever scored 6 in a top-flight English game. Jeff Hurst in West Ham's 8-0 win over Sunderland in 1968. And it's been done 5 times. 5 goals in games have been done 5 times in the Premier League.
You make it sound like it's an anniversary. You make a point of marking.
It's a bleak day. It's a bleak day. Although, of course, only our joint work.
There are many bleak days.
We lost 8-0 to Southampton 3 or 4 years ago. Wow. 8 goals.
I was at that.
Were you?
I think so, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I was.
I mean, I can see why you try and blank it out. But yeah, Cole, Shearer, Defoe, Berbatov and Aguero. The 5 have scored 5 in the Premier League.
It's so impressive that you just know all that off the
top
of your head.
Yeah, it's almost like I've got a list in front of me that I Just googled while listening to Archie.
It's Champions League this week. Anyone off to a game?
I'm going to Old Trafford tomorrow. My first Champions League reporting job for The Guardian.
Exciting.
I'm very excited.
Oh, great one to get as well.
Absolutely. So
do you think they'll have a little quiz for you when you first get there?
God, I hope not, because I'm cutting the train time so fine. I'm basically going to have to get in there, sit down, Wi-Fi, work.
Wi-Fi at Old Trafford, you'll be lucky.
Oh, is it?
It's terrible.
Oh, mate.
No, the press release at Old Trafford are a disgrace.
Is that true? Yeah. Do you think the Glazers have run it down?
Well, they haven't done them up, certainly. Oh. Yeah, it's very cramped, and the food is pretty poor, and the Wi-Fi, as Paul Pogba found to his cost this season, is horrendous.
We've had so much to get through today. We haven't got a huge amount of time for questions. There's just one that we've picked out from Zvonimir, which is, how jealous is Wilson of Barry's respectability?
I'm a maverick. You can't make me respectable. That's, you know, they can't tame me. I'm a lone wolf.
You do look quite bothered, though, actually.
Yeah, I'm furious.
And with each phrase, and that, you sound more and more like a terrorist.
Barry's a man well into middle age. I can understand that he's, you know, he's put on the slippers and picked up the pipe and he's aiming at respectability, but, you know, not for me.
Yeah, fair enough.
Guys, thank you for today. Paul, thank you very much.
No, thank you, Melissa.
Jonathan, thank you.
Cheers, thank you.
Barry, thank you.
You're very welcome, Melissa.
We'll be back on Thursday to talk through Champions League and all the Premier League previews too.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.